In fact, we did an interesting paper where we started from the farmer's point of view, and we worked with 45 farms, and we asked farmers about what was their best, most productive field that they thought was in the best condition, and what was their problem field. Usually it was a rented field versus their own or something like that, and we studied what the differences were. And the differences were almost never standard soil tests. You know, it wasn't pH, it wasn't phosphorus level, something like that. It almost always related to organic matter and soil structure and water holding capacity and the way it had been managed. And so that's what really gave us some insight, starting with the farmer's point of view and, you know, and figuring out why they were having more success with one field than another. So
we want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com. Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I am Brian Arnell, and I am coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. Today, I'm excited to have on Professor Ray Weil. He's an internationally recognized expert on soil science, nutrient cycling, soil organic matter, and cover crop systems for soil health and water quality at the University of Maryland. His methods for soil microbial biomass and active carbon (POX) are adopted by USDA, NRCS, and researchers worldwide. And I've been following him as a young soil scientist. I have looked up to Dr. Weil for my entire career, watching and learning from him and his writings. And honestly, it's an honor to have you on today. When I saw the name pop up on the guest list, because I don't get to select, I'm like, man, this is a little bit of a starstruck moment. So Dr. Weil, thank you so much for coming on with us today. And I look forward to our conversation.
I look forward to it too.
Tell our listeners a little bit about how you became, you know, the internationally recognized soil scientist that you have.
Well, I guess it goes back to when I was a kid. I'm probably older than you think. And when I was in high school and looking to go to college, the world was starving. There wasn't enough food. And I'm not talking about ethanol here. I'm talking about just plain food. Population was growing. And as an idealistic kid, I wanted to do something about it. And I wanted to become a medical doctor, actually, and start out pre-med. But I had the wisdom at the age of 20 in my junior year to realize I was too absent-minded. Yes, at 20, I was absent-minded. So I might not be safe as a medical doctor. I could envision, you know, sewing somebody up and saying, oh, dang, I forgot to take that clip out and have to go back. And I figured maybe I should save the world in a little less life-threatening way. And that's why I switched to agriculture. I switched universities to Michigan State University and studied crop and soil science and joined the Peace Corps and worked in Africa to try to promote that dream. And I've worked in Africa quite a bit ever since, many African countries over the years, but I've been working primarily in the U.S. with farmers, trying to advance the way we farm and what they call now regenerative agriculture. I guess we used to call it sustainable agriculture. Back in the day, I wasn't even allowed to teach a course called sustainable agriculture. Back in the 1980s, there was that kind of friction going on, but I think that's much improved these days.
That's fantastic. I love hearing the background, and many of ours are about the same. I had this idealistic approach. I was going to be an educator. I was going to teach until I realized that I didn't like young kids or their parents often. And so I moved through and I still get to educate, but it's a little bit of an older audience. So, Dr. Weil, talk a little bit about some of your work. You know, what is your passion right now? What are you working on the most?
Well, my passion is soils. Once I got into that, it's such an important topic, and it affects so many different aspects of our lives, even if you're not a farmer. So, mostly farmers appreciate it because they work with it every day with their hands, and they realize that. But we all depend on soil for so many things. And the more I got into it, the more I found it fascinating. As you know, I write a textbook, which is used all over the world. It's recently translated into Chinese. So there's probably, I don't know how many thousands of students that are reading my vision of soils over in China. So so that was, I started that, inherited that, I should say, in the early 1990s. That book has been going since 1909. It was originally a Cornell kind of farm handbook series.
I did not realize that that book was that old. It had a legacy going back to 1909. That's fascinating.
Mind you, I didn't. I wasn't the original author, of course. But yeah, so these days I've been actually, I would say for the last 20 years, I've been focusing on cover crops because it's such an excellent tool. It's something farmers can use to improve their soils, usually combined with their tillage system or their no tillage system, preferably. You know, these are really important for improving the health of soils. Soil health is a term that's, you know, being used more and more now. We used to call it soil quality. I think you might have called it just soil tilth and fertility at one point. Mm-hmm. But any farmer knows what I'm talking about. In fact, we did an interesting paper where we started from the farmer's point of view, and we worked with 45 farms, and we asked farmers about what was their best, most productive field that they thought was in the best condition, and what was their problem field. Usually it was a rented field versus their own or something like that, and we studied what the differences were. And the differences were almost never standard soil tests. You know, it wasn't pH, it wasn't phosphorus level, something like that. It almost always related to organic matter and soil structure and water holding capacity and the way it had been managed. And so that's what really gave us some insight, starting with the farmer's point of view and, you know, and figuring out why they were having more success with one field than another. So I've been working on that, cover cropping systems, and not just, you know, adopting cover crops and trying to use them, but making sure you use them in a way that makes sense, that's going to make money for you, and that's, you know, going to get results. So that's been my passion for quite a while, and that relates to kind of organic matter, nutrient cycling. Even been working on slugs lately, because that's one of the barriers to getting people to use multi-species cover crops and let them grow big and plant green and that kind of thing. Is it's great wildlife habitat, and one of those wildlife creatures are the slugs, and they can come up and decimate crops.
Yeah, so that's fascinating. I got to jump in because so we don't have, we're dry enough where slugs don't go entire state, but we're getting more pill bugs. So it's the slugs in the east and the pill bugs in the west. What are you doing and what are you seeing as far as management strategies for slugs, because that is something. We have all that green matter, that green decaying matter or live matter. Slugs have been an issue.
You know, you're in Oklahoma and I'm in Maryland, and you know, although this year we probably didn't get any more rain than you did, we were really, really, really dry. We went like 2 months with virtually no rainfall. It's the first time in my life in the U.S. that I've seen dead, not stressed, but outright dead cornfields. Mm-hmm. So it was that bad on some of our sandy soils. But given that, we usually have about 4 inches of rain a month, pretty much year-round on average. Of course, averages, you know, you never find the average. But the worry with farmers, especially most of our farmers are no-till, and most of our farmers use cover crops. So our average, quote, conventional farmer is practicing primarily no-till, and uses cover crops on most of the farm, you know, so that's kind of our starting point. So in that way, we're kind of ahead of most of the rest of the country, mm-hmm. Where it's more like maybe, you know, 30% no-till and 10% cover crops or something. So, you know, that undisturbed soil is the way nature intended it to be, and it's great habitat. We, you know, when we go out sampling, we find snakes and voles, and the birds are flying around. And actually, I've had farmers tell me that that's how they judge how successful they are, by how their fields sound when they walk out. And I'm talking about farmers that are farming thousands of acres.
Yeah,
they want to walk out in their field and hear the birds singing. If they don't hear a lot of birds singing, they figure there's no life chain going down below there for the birds to eat. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the slugs, you know, if the only thing is green in the spring, you kill your cover crop early, what we call early. I mean, the normal practice is to kill a cover crop, you know, 3 weeks or so before you're planning to plant. Or most farmers actually think, well, let's get that done as soon as possible, right? Get it out of the way. We don't want the cover crop to get away. So you do that, you don't have much residue. You plant into that no-till. Mm-hmm. You've got all this nice, you know, hiding places for slugs. It's wet. And then your little soybeans come up, and that's the only green living thing in sight. And of course, the worst thing is if you're planting into a soil that's on the wet side, mm-hmm. and you're planting slot doesn't quite close, and the slugs would just run right down that highway and go from seed to seed after they're imbibed and starting to germinate, and they'll just nip them off. So you can have real disastrous stand hits. But what we found, and it sounds like it'd be worse if you let the cover crops grow, mm-hmm. but actually we found that we've done this now probably about 20 site years of data, so we're still working on it, but we've done it on quite a few different fields over about 4 years on different conditions. We have never found that letting the cover crops grow all the way until planting time has made it worse. Mm-hmm. You may have more slugs, but you don't get more damage. And often we find you actually get less damage. And that kind of depends on what the cover crop is and what the crop is and what the conditions are. There's a couple of things going on, I think. One is if you plant green and then, spray the cover crop and it takes a week to die, your crop isn't the only thing that slugs can eat. And we see the slugs on the cover crop eating. So your crop is just one of many. And, a week or two later, it's going to be the only green thing. Mm-hmm. Important. But by then, it's going to be, big enough to survive. So that's been really interesting to us, the water dynamics. Cover crops use water, of course, but where that water comes from and how that balances out, that'd be a bigger issue for you in Oklahoma. I think you can manage them. So, yes, they use some water, but on balance, they're going to actually get more water into the soil. And they often create better conditions in that planting zone. So, it works pretty well. Planting green sounds crazy. As you know, there are farmers all over the country doing it. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a little practice. you want to be ready to adjust your planter and your down pressure and all that. To make it work, but it actually works better than planting into dead residue. And I've had many farmers tell me that, that some of them done it by mistake because herbicide got plugged up or something, and they have a patch of staining cover crops. Mm-hmm. And I said, whoa, the planter really glides through that. It doesn't have to cut through the residue. The living roots keep the soil more friable. It closes up better. It's something I think farmers ought to try.
Oklahoma's kind of an interesting state. While I would say our adoption of cover crops is quite low, we're in a system where wheat's dominant. So almost always after a summer crop, we're planting wheat for grazing or grain. And after wheat, if there's moisture, we're planting a double crop. So while we don't necessarily have a significant cover amount of covers, we're usually producing something in the acreages year round. And so there's some conversations, are we doing the right thing by not doing a cover crop? But if we can grow a cash crop after a wheat crop, it's growing and we're managing. And same thing, if corn or cotton or soy comes off in time and there's moisture, we're almost always planting a winter wheat, maybe a barley or a triticale. And if that fails, then we're probably going to the same ground with the spring oat because we have such a cattle and grain integrated system that we're always looking for forages in the fall or the spring.
Yeah, no, that's serving many of the same functions as a cover crop. If you've got the small grain in there, and as you know, most people that grow cover crops are growing small grain. They're growing wheat, rye, or barley or something. Mm-hmm. Grazing, it's also a good option. If it has to be done carefully, the soil has to be in the right time, and you want the cover crop or the crop to be at the right stage and everything for maximum nutrition, but getting that manure and some of that stomping around is a good thing. Yeah.
I wanted to transition us a little bit, Dr. Wallach, because I'm currently on interim director of our public soil testing lab, and I'm the director and, I guess, founder of our research soil testing lab that's a full 5 years old. So I've been watching what you do when it comes to your methodology, because trying to measure soil health, soil quality, the soil parameters that matter, there's been a lot out there. What was your process? How was your process in methods and in developing and working through methods for what I see as a repeatable and usable value?
Well, yeah, so you're trying to actually see what sort of condition the soil is in, how healthy it is, whether management practices have had an effect. First thing to realize is that some of these properties that you're interested in and the way the soil functions is not something you can measure on a handful of soil in the lab or a scoop of soil, right? So once you've got the sample sort of ground up, dried, and in a little bag, that limits the kind of thing you can measure.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to measure much biology. You could moisten it and measure DNA, diversity, and that kind of thing. You'd never be able to interpret it. So you're starting with a highly altered system.
Yes.
A lot of things that are really important, like infiltration rate and penetration resistance and structural stability, many of those things are best measured in the field. Or just observed, look what happens when you get when you get that heavy rainstorm, and our rains are coming, heavier, but less frequent. So it's getting more and more important that we're able to handle this high volume of water when the storms do hit. So you want to make that real clear that a lot of the soil health parameters are things that little bag of soil is not going to tell you. So we faced this challenge, I hate to think back on it. It's been a quarter century ago. So in the 90s, in the mid-90s, I was trying to answer that question for us. If you have this little bag of soil that you've got into the soil test lab, what can you measure on it that was in keeping with those findings that we found that the farmer's best field wasn't any different with regard to soil tests, standard soil tests. But it was mostly organic matter related, not always total organic matter. That's when we came up with that, what's now called POXC, permanganate oxidizable carbon. And our challenge was actually, we wanted to do this in the field. We wanted to, and you're an extension, and farmers would know. Our vision was that farmers would do this themselves. Well, that's not going to happen much, maybe once in a workshop or something like that, as a teaching tool. But, farmers aren't going to have the time to go out and make all these kinds of comparisons, the way a researcher might do. So they are going to end up sending a sample into a lab. And there are a number of labs that use this. Researchers all over the world use this. And I still think it's one of the most reliable and repeatable measurements. It's very simple to do. You can do it. We made a little kit. I think the Ohio State University, where my former grad student who worked with me on that, he's now running one of their experiment stations. I believe they're actually selling a little kit, but it's very simple. It's a reaction with permanganate, potassium permanganate, which is completely harmless. And I'm not saying you can eat it. There's a lot of things you can't eat that are harmless. But you can throw it out on the soil, and it's just going to go back into the elements in the soil. It might stain your clothes purple, though. And it reacts with a portion of the organic matter that is indicative of whether the soil is starting to accumulate more organic matter and supporting a healthy microbiology system. And it's usually pretty responsive to changes in management, like tillage and cover crops and fertility and crop rotations and that kind of thing. And it's cheap and easy to do. So, and it's been used now all over the world. The results are going to have to be correlated a little bit to the kind of soils you have, and especially with regard to texture. You expect lower levels on sandier soils than you do on finer textured soils. But it's pretty reliable in terms of the kind of soil health things. There are other things you can use that might work regionally. Of course, Haney has worked on nitrogen test and organic matter test. You can do the soil respiration, which is a little bit different thing than the permanganate test. Of course, you're starting out with a soil that's dried up and pretty dead, and of course it has the resting stages. Then you're going to wet it. Everybody comes to life, and you get this burst of CO2. So that's something. But it's a whole lot more labor. You got to incubate it for either 24 hours or 72 hours in little jars and all that kind of thing. So, and I don't think it adds much to the story if you just wanted to get kind of one measurement that goes a little bit beyond the regular extractable nutrients and that kind of thing. The other thing is how you get that sample. This is really important. The changes, if you're tilling the soil thoroughly, it doesn't matter too much. You want to get it from that tilled horizon because things are being stirred up, you know, at least every year, a couple times a year. But if you're in a more no-till system, things do stratify, and that's not a bad thing. That's the way the natural systems work. Nutrients are mostly near the surface, but if they're under a mulch, roots are able to concentrate there and proliferate. You know, plants are adapted. Plant doesn't expect to find the nutrients evenly spread out throughout the soil. That's not the way it is in nature. So plants are adapted at sensing when there's a high nutrient area, and they actually send resources to that part of the root system, and they increase growth in it, and they increase the speed at which they take up nutrients, so they can get all their nutrients from one little area. And that's that. We know that from banding fertilizers. You don't have to mix them in. So what you get with a no-till system is kind of a horizontal band where it's banded along the surface. And that's not a bad thing, but you're going to miss it. If you take a deep soil sample to 6 or 8 inches, you're not going to see what's happening in that top 1 or 2 inches. So I really recommend that you separate out that top 2 inches from the deeper sample and test both.
So that's interesting, because I was actually wondering, you know, in Oklahoma, we're on average getting 20 to 36 inches of rainfall. And we also find that it's that top 1 to 2 inches. I was curious if in a higher rainfall environment like Maryland or the Eastern Shore, or even in the Corn Belt, if it wouldn't be just slightly deeper, but you're still saying it's the top 2 inches, even within a more productive region that has more rainfall.
Well, the changes start at the surface, and so it's, you know, it's not a cutoff, but, mm-hmm. but most of the increased organic matter, most of the increased biology, and then you have to understand that whether you're growing a small grain or cover crop, it's more so with a cover crop because you're mm-hmm. you're leaving all the residue, you know, you're not harvesting anything, right? It's all being left. But that's pretty similar to what happens with grazing. You're talking about grazing small grains or triticale. You know, there's this pumping that goes up. These nutrients that have either leached down, they've either washed down with the rain. Now, you probably, 20 inches of rain, they're not going to go all that far. They probably only go down a couple of feet. And that's as far as they go, and then they start moving back up, right? Mm-hmm. So, but the roots will go down as far as there's moisture. And then they'll bring these nutrients up into the leaves. Some of the nutrients, like potash, it'll just wash out of the leaves. You get a rain on your triticale, and a lot of the potash is just washing out of the leaves, and now it's fertilizing the top of the soil. So it's bringing it up to the surface, concentrating it, and it'll slowly move down again. So every time you're growing a crop, especially a graze, you know, mm-hmm. a small grain or something, it'll do that. And the residue you leave behind has a lot of nutrients in it as well. Now, if you're taking off the soybeans or corn or cotton or whatever, you know, a lot of the nutrients are in what you harvest. But those residues are mostly at the surface, and most of the roots are near the surface, the closer you get to the surface. If you have a mulch, if you've got a bare soil, then that surface dries out too much for roots to grow, and that's where you have problems if the nutrients are up in that dry zone. But as long as your soil's covered, mm-hmm. That'll keep it as moist as the rest of the soil. It pretty much eliminates, you don't want evaporation. You know, evaporation is just that you only get 20 inches of rain, and 15 inches of those evaporate from the soil surface. You know, that does not leave much for your crop. Now, you don't want evaporation.
Yeah, we have some long-term fertility trials here established in the late 60s by Dr. Billy Tucker, and they've been now no-till for about 15 to 17 years, depending on which location, and we've sampled those. And even the stratification and the non-fertilized check, you know, a plot that's not been fertilized since 1968 or 1969, is significant. It's been fun documenting that by the inch level, the change in the soil dynamics and soil property, chemical and physical properties of these different treatments that have been, you know, they were established in the late 60s, converted to no-till around 2002, 2007, depending on location. Just the magnitude of stratification that we can see in such a short period of time, it was just fascinating.
Well, it's important to go ahead and understand that and take that into account when you sample for soil tests, because if you have that stratification, which you have out in the rangeland too,
yeah,
under more natural undisturbed conditions, and you take a sample that's 8 inches deep, and you're diluting that nutrient level, you know, and what's important for many nutrients, especially for the immobile ones like phosphorus and some of the micronutrients, is that the concentrations be high enough in a small zone that the plant, that the nutrient's available enough, right? And I really think we need to probably work on adjusting our recommendations based on, you know, some of these zone, you know, it's a difficult problem for sampling, whether it's whether it's horizontal or vertical. If you're banding fertilizer, it's also really difficult to sample that. You hit, you know, you hit the fertilizer band and you've way exaggerated the nutrients, but if you miss it, you've way underestimated. So, you know, it's not as simple as it was in the days when everything was broadcast and plowed in.
Exactly right.
But that doesn't mean we should broadcast and plowed in just because it makes the research and the testing simpler. You know, it's definitely not as good.
Yeah, I've got a lot more questions for you, Dr. Wild, but I guess this is the final comment. That's one thing that I've noticed, and I love variability. I love spatial dynamics, both horizontal and vertical. And so that's where most of my research is in even the vertical variability across the landscape and the drivers of crop response to nutrients, crop yield, and those. But this one thing that I think is really fascinating as we go into more conservation, as we go into cover crops, is that we do make some of the nutrient management decisions more challenging, as we're in some cases intensifying our variability, whether stratified vertically or horizontally, because a cover crop mixture, if I've got four species, at least here, we don't get equal germination and growth of four species across the landscape. We have dominance of a grass in one spot, a brassica, and a legume. And so some of our best methodologies that do improve soil health, soil parameters, are also increasing spatial variance both horizontally and vertically.
Yeah, and that's also with time. So you can't count on that variance being the same each year. One of the big advantages of those multi-species mixes is that they become adaptable. So, you know, the species that dominate will be different in different parts of the field or in different years or in different planting times. You planted 2 weeks earlier, and you're going to get a very different looking mixture than with the same seed. And I think that's often not appreciated. We tell them what seed to plant, you know, and then you go with that. But really, it's going to be different. But that's a good thing. That's an adaptability. But it does make the measurement of it more challenging, right? So whether we can account for that variability or whether we have to go with the average and let the plant account for it. So yield monitors are great that way if you can correlate that with what you're seeing and what you've done in the field. And now that we've got yield monitors, that's a whole new world of information that's really useful.
It's time for our famous three.
Yes. Dr. Wild, we got to wrap up. So I have the three final questions for you. One is, you know, what is a go-to work resource? Where do you go when you have questions?
I shouldn't say this, but I often go to my own book. It's 1,000-plus pages. It's got a pen season. It's designed, some of the students don't appreciate this, it's designed both as a reference for the profession and as an introduction. And that's kind of a challenge to be good for both. Yes. So it's a little bit challenging as an introduction, but it's but it is a good reference. So that's where I often look things up if I'm looking up specific facts in my head.
What is your favorite leisurely activity? What do you do in your free time?
Oh gosh, when I can do it, I love to garden. We had temperatures down. It was 20 degrees a couple nights ago. I put a couple old bed sheets over some of my beans that I'm still eating and that kind of thing to keep them going a little bit longer. I love gardening and eating stuff fresh from the garden. I always enjoyed that.
Fantastic. And then finally, where do people go to find out more about your work and your lab?
The name is spelled W-E-I-L, Ray's my first name, Ray Weil, comma soil or comma cover crop, or if you're interested, radish. We didn't mention radish, but I'm sort of known as the father of the forage radish, or tillage radish. That's an interesting story for another podcast sometime.
Well, folks, that wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wyzenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guest, Dr. Ray Weil, professor of soil science, University of Maryland, co-author of The Ray and Weil, The Nature of Properties of Soils, the book that really every soil scientist has read and has on the shelf in multiple multiple copies. I keep six in my office so I can hand them out as students come in and go because they've lost their copies. So I've definitely contributed to that as itself. Folks, you know, if you enjoyed this podcast, subscribe to the channel so you get notifications when we have a new one drop. Share the video with your friends, your colleagues, and just folks that you converse with daily. Leave us any comments if you have suggestions on new guests or questions for the guests we've had on. Dr. Wall, again, I was tickled when I saw your name pop up. And it's been a joy, and I really hope to bring you on at another opportunity to go dig deeper into the tillage radish and the forage radish.
Great. It's been a pleasure. We'll see you again sometime.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.